The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. I am joined by Euan Erasmus, a pastor in South Africa who holds degrees in both philosophy and theology and is currently doing his PhD on race and reconciliation. And Euan recently shared his fascinating story in this fab new book called Coming to Faith Through Dawkins. Euan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Ruth, no problem.
Now, what I love doing with people is going right back to the beginning. So I guess my first question to you would be, what was your experience of God growing up in South Africa?
Look, I mean, I reluctantly took part in the book. I really think, well, one, I'm careful of this testimony sensationalization. I often felt as if in church circles, that the one who had the most sex and the most drugs and the most and came to Christ, you know, there was a higher hierarchy. So people were almost competing in terms of testimony. So I reluctantly took part in this book. It was a good exercise for me nonetheless. But my beginning of my Christian faith, I grew up in a very good Christian home, whatever that may mean. And in South Africa, in the Afrikaner community back then, it would have been very conservative. And we grew up in a Reformed church, but faith was also pretty boring. It wasn't necessarily a very vibrant church. You know, there wasn't such a thing as Sunday school, apart from the church service. You had to sit there and just suck it up. So it's a little bit like I assume you guys feel about Anglican chapel services in your public schools or whatever. You know, there are lots of Monty Python skits about the trauma that that comes from chapel. So I guess that was my experience. But I was just surrounded by Christians, a lot of it cultural Christians, but a lot of it, I think, genuine as well. And then I think even though as a young kid, I was mostly occupied with things called rugby and cricket. And later on, maybe girls. But that stopped abruptly when my father died of a heart attack. He was in his early 40s. I was 12. And from that day, it just didn't satisfy me anymore to just play rugby, play cricket, run after girls. I had bigger questions that I was wrestling with. And I mean, it's almost overnight that all these questions of... where is my dad now? How sure are we about that? And what about who made God? All of these things just came to me all at once. And these were questions that I soon realized you didn't ask in this very conservative environment. It wasn't malicious. Like I wasn't this victim. Or like these days, everybody's talking about trauma. They had religious trauma. I didn't have religious trauma. But the questions I was asking was not the questions that the other, you know, the people in my environment were trying to answer. And you know, I remember having these crises in the middle of the night. And to my poor mother's detriment, I would wake her up at 12 and just say, "How do we know God exists? We made God." And my mom, I mean, she's not the best apologist at any time of the day, but she's especially poor at 12 o'clock at night, in the morning, when her 12-year-old boy is just bombarding her with questions like these. And then she would phone the minister and he would earn his keep, and I would drive, I would be dropped off there and spend time 3 a.m. talking about theology. And then somehow I didn't think about these things, but when I went to sleep and when I woke up, I was woken up with these questions. And then... But I mean, I quickly, the way in which this particular pastor, and God bless his soul, he's wonderful people. I don't want to assassinate any characters or any traditions or whatever. But back then, the things that white Afrikaners were thinking about are black people and the Black Danger. And that's going to take over the country. Communism, the Red Danger. The only apologetics were actually geared against Catholics. So we were still fighting the Catholics of the 1500s. And there was very little geared towards questions of ultimate reality, like does this whole thing even exist? So I always said, my question is not how to believe. My question is whether to believe. And you guys are just talking about how to believe, you know, through Mary or the Pope or and you guys say no scripture alone, and you guys say no grace, whatever. That's not my question. I don't want to know how to believe. I want to know why to believe. And that question just never emerged in the circles that I found myself in. And it was a very lonely place. And I distinctly remember getting a book that somehow ended up in our school library. It just said, "Does God exist?" Afrikaans. And I took it out and I said, "Oh, wow. I didn't know that we were allowed to ask these questions." And as I was reading it in the library, one of my classmates just came running. "Oh, what are you reading?" She grabs the book. She says, "Oh, how dare you? How dare you read this?" I need to hide this like I would hide cigarettes. And that's what I did. You know, I started to hid my skepticism, and I realized that there were a lot of places that I couldn't necessarily voice it. So my earliest memories of Christianity and sort of moving over a little bit into skepticism, it wasn't through trauma. It wasn't through anything. I mean, obviously, my dad dying. I've read somewhere that most philosophers, they lost their dads at an early age. I'm a useless philosopher, so I can't claim that it had a great effect on me. But at least it got me thinking about bigger questions. And maybe in hindsight, I can see God's hand in that.
And one of the things that you mention in coming to faith through Dawkins is that I think it was an English teacher, you said, at school gave you a collection of C.S. Lewis's essays. Was that your first interaction with C.S. Lewis?
Oh, yeah. I can't remember because I don't have the book anymore. But I'm pretty sure it was God in the Docks. You know, it was sort of these one-liners. It wasn't sort of trying to tell a story or making a case for miracles. It was sort of a random attempt explaining versions of Christianity. And she was a good friend of my mom, so she would often visit at home, and I just always listened to her, and she was very open about her faith. And I sort of ventured to voice my skepticism around her, and she was my English teacher as well. And then she was just so calm and unoffended by anything I asked. And she just gave me this C.S. Lewis book. She would later give me Tolstoy books as well, and had all the other guy, Dostoevsky, and a lot of people that played a pivotal role in her conversion, but in a very soft, understated way. She never even spoke to me about the books. She was just sort of bringing the books. It's almost a little bit like a typical story or a movie protagonist, the sort of a Mr. Miyagi in Karate Kid. You know, this sort of this wise person from the outside just gently giving me books and allowing me to stumble and fall and learn. So that was my first interaction.
And what did you make of that book at the time? Because obviously you were quite young.
Yeah, so this was early high school. I'm not the brightest guy in the world, and I'm not the brightest Afrikaans guy in the world. So a C.S. Lewis book in high school, it didn't necessarily just leap off the page. I had to work a little bit to get it. I've got other friends in primary school. They read The Problem of Pain. It was no problem. I hate those people because, you know, that's not me. I struggled through these things. But I remember there was a guy talking about myth and the fact that the Bible is not like that. And just as a literary historian and a literary theorist, he would say, "Look, this is not it," and he would make a case for it. And I remember just thinking, "This is it." And whenever I had a chance to talk about Christians, I would just sort of have this one trick of, of saying, yeah, I remember sit there, sit back. And I held on to that with everything in me. But it was a flimsy faith. You know, there wasn't much or any Bible reading for that matter, but my little God in the docks, I think, did that. That traveled with me. So on the one hand, I didn't necessarily probe and ask, did he write anything else? So maybe I wasn't as hungry as I think I was. On the other hand, that was the only little bit of information that I had about faith that seemed to make sense.
Well, and there's a great line in the book, Coming to Faith Through Dawkins, where you say, the little I could understand, I think because the book was in English rather than Afrikaans, which is your first language. The little I could understand was very helpful, though. And I remember thinking to myself that if I believed one day, it would probably be because of C.S. Lewis. And that's, I think, really significant because, as we'll hear a little bit later, C.S. Lewis, what you now do love C.S. Lewis. And obviously, some of those arguments were kind of what captivated you. But I'm really interested. You said that you were later told that Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia were satanic. I mean, why did people think that? And what was your response to that, having, I guess, only a small interaction, but an interaction that was largely positive with C.S. Lewis?
Yeah, so I held on to this little booklet because it is more a booklet than a book, rather than the dot. And I remember starting reading Harry Potter and really liking Harry Potter as well. So I've got C.S. Lewis, I've got Harry Potter, and I've got Narnia, and I quite like Narnia as well. And I come to this church camp, and they do this talk on Satanism. Everybody's going to go to this Satanism talk. That sounds interesting. What are they going to talk about? Slipknot, or, you know, the usual suspects. No. J.K. Rowling and C.S. Lewis. I just remember thinking, goodness me, these Christians are whack. And I even said, C.S. Lewis was like an outspoken Christian. Like, it was, why? He's like this, I didn't know the word apologist back then, but he's like this apologist of sorts. Why is he the enemy? These guys sit like, stay away from it. And Harry Potter as well. Like, Harry Potter is of the devil. I'm sure you guys had a little bit of that nonsense as well. And I just felt, well, everything that's good, all the music that's good, all the movies and books that's good, Satan had something to do with that. So maybe I must change allegiances. but it was just sort of a fundamentalist Christian version. And again, the people meant well, that they were serious, but they were deluded.
And one of the things that I think really struck me was that it was conversations with a friend of yours who had been studying theology in the States, and she came back and you were having conversations with her, I guess, throwing some of these ideas that you had got from the New Atheist. Would you just say a little bit about those conversations? Because they were quite a significant turning point for you, weren't
Such
they?
Such a pivotal moment, yeah. So this friend, I mean, she studied here in South Africa. She went to London, worked there, I think, as a teacher, and then went to the States and she studied philosophy and theology, but with a very strong focus on apologetics. I think she studied under Norman Geisler. She was well versed in sort of mainstream apologetics. And I went to her and she asked her, "So what are you doing now?" I thought she was still teaching in London. She said, "No, she's studying theology." I'm like, "Ooh, okay." Yeah. And I remember she was a smart girl in school. She was really smart. So I thought, okay, well, have you read these guys, the Hitchens, the Harrises, the Dawkins? And usually that didn't mean anything to anybody in the circles I moved, but she recognized those names. And then she said, very disappointingly, you really need to get yourself some better atheists. I'm like, what? So what do you mean? She said, well, look, I've got no problem with you being a skeptic, and I've got no problem about you losing your faith and whatnot, but have some self-respect. If you lose your faith, at least read the likes of Michael Ruse or Thomas Nagel or John Gray or the like. But if you're going to give it up this easily, I'm going to be offended. And I'm like, what? I didn't expect it. So she was not only telling me that she knows my atheist, but she was advising me to read better atheists than these atheists. And then I said, okay, well, maybe that's just a cute rhetorical trick. So who made God? Boom. Yeah. That's the knockdown question. Who made God? Yeah. Why are you going to have like infinite causality and it doesn't make sense? Blah, blah, blah. And then she just went on and said, okay. I mean, we've been thinking about this at least until the, at least from the Middle Ages, probably before that. And she starts articulating Thomas Aquinas and the fact that if time began at creation, then God does not exist inside that realm. She just went on a little bit. I didn't expect that. And then I threw some of the problem of evil stuff, sort of the conflict between science and faith. I mean, I can't remember the details, but she just went very on. She said, well, there are a couple of scientists that's going to disagree with you. And I remember she mentioned Alice de McGraw's name. I didn't know anything about it, but subsequently I did actually with his literature. She just mentioned name-dropping all of these Christian scientists who are both committed Christians and committed scientists. I guess I didn't know that. And it just lasted hours and hours and hours into that night. I just refused to go to sleep. I would often like to make a conscience. We're not done. Get up. And I just couldn't stop. It was like drinking out of a hose pipe, and I just refused to close it. And that was a very fateful encounter with my old friend Cornelia.
Well, I suppose compared to some of the kind of shutting down of those questions that you'd experienced previously, it must have been so refreshing to have someone not only, you know, say these questions are valid, but actually really begin to engage with you on those questions and provide some answers that you didn't even think were possible.
So I think the juxtaposition, you're right, is what made it such a fascinating encounter. Is that I knew she took her faith seriously from early days. So I knew I'm gonna probe a little bit more and see how she reacts to this. By then I didn't really worry anymore how people respond. And then she did dismiss the atheist objections. I remember just giving her some version of the problem of evil. You know, if God is all powerful and if he's all loving, then he would want to rid the world of evil, and he would be able to rid the world of evil. So why is that evil? I think they attributed to Epicurus or someone. And then, I mean, I can't remember how she formulated it. She said, I think we can make that even stronger. She said, if God is a God of love, and he actually brings in other attributes, and she just makes the point stronger. I'm like, yeah, okay, let's go with that one. That's what I wanted to say.
Let's have your objection.
Yeah, that's mine. Yeah. Good luck answering that thing that you just, you know, bitted on. And then she just went on. She said, well, this is the problem with it. And then she said, well, Alvin Plantinga, I had pretty much solved this thing. So it was the complete opposite of everything that I've experienced before that. It was this environment, not only in which it was encouraged to be skeptical, but I had to be a better skeptic than I was. So she wanted the best out of my skepticism so she could answer that. So very bizarre, meaningful encounter.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Was there a particular moment when some of the new atheists' theology, philosophy, arguments began to slightly crumble?
Look, I mean, she gave me a CD with a lot of William Lane Craig lectures, and went back and just started listening to these things and comparing it. In our hostel, that I stayed at Varsity, we were a couple of skeptics, so we would listen to it together. But we would even have a Letter to a Christian Nation or God Is Not Great on our laps, you know, whilst we're listening to this. blood delusion, going through it a little bit, just fact checking it a bit. So there was a good discussion around it, but I think when I encountered that rich intellectual tradition, it came down like a house of cards at first, I should say, and the new atheist didn't stack up very well, and it was only after a while, because I can't say that my conversion was this linear thing. I saw the light. There was, I don't know, Enya music or Gregorian chants in the background. It was it was very rocky, up and down and whatever. So even though I sort of lost the interest in the new atheist a little bit, as I dug a little bit deeper, went into apologetics or whatever, I discovered other atheists. That is a good objection. Maybe I was I was excited too early about this. And then later on, I would just also experience feelings of doubt. It would just seem to me like the material universe is all there is, and maybe the universe is just that, and maybe it is just random. That wasn't necessarily because I read something. It was just a feeling of doubt that I had. So the new atheist house of cards came tumbling down pretty quickly, but that doesn't mean that my skepticism just came crashing down with it, because as you dig in, you encounter some of these better atheists and you look, oh wow, that is compelling. And if you encounter some of these objections, especially as a complete novice like I was, like the first time you encounter an objection, it's like, oh, this is game over.
Wow.
This is game over. And then you hear a counter argument, like, oh wow, now it's game over. And then you hear, because you're sort of at a very low level in, and it's very simplistic, and your emotions really goes with you. You agree with whoever is standing on the podium at that stage, you know, in as much as you're watching a debate. And only later, much later, that I sort of sort out my own emotions and my own opinions about everything.
And so, you know, you're beginning to delve into these Christian apologists, apologetic arguments. Right. Was there a particular argument that made you think, well, Christianity may actually be a credible worldview? I suppose it's one thing for the atheistic arguments to sort of be crumbling down, but was there something from a more positive side looking at the apologetics that really began to make sense for you?
Look, I should say I wasn't completely thorough. The one thing that really came crashing down was there was this anger at the world that I experienced in the literature of the New Atheists, and this anger at human dysfunction. Hitchens would just go on about, why didn't God intervene in the Holocaust? I mean, goodness me, at what point is it time for him to just jump out of his ivory heavenly tower and just do something about it? Dawkins also got really anger at this passivity in the face of injustice. And when I heard the contradiction between a blind, pitiless, material universe and these strong feelings of morality and a sense of justice and the fact that doesn't belong in any absolute terms in a materialist worldview, like, oh my goodness, yeah, that. And a lot of the new atheist literature comes crashing down once you've pointed out that discrepancy right there, because it's really angry at God and injustice and this immorality that persists and that God doesn't do anything. So just to backtrack a little bit, that was one of the things that that really took a massive chunk out of the sting of the new atheists. In terms of the Christian argument, I remember being blown away by the cosmological argument and then not being blown away by the cosmological argument, like pausing again because I'm finding a good critique. And then, I think this thing stands. And the moral argument, I've always found, not always found convincing, obviously, but from the first time I heard it, although, you know, you sort of go again through ebbs and flows, those two arguments really made an impact, but it definitely didn't stop there, because even though at first it really intrigued me and made me take the claims of Christianity more seriously, and by the way, also the resurrection. I just heard this first time I heard N.T. Wright talk about the resurrection, I mean, this guy just, he sounds a little bit like I would imagine God to sound like. And I mean, don't tell anybody that, but he he's just giving the historical account of the resurrection. Jesus, okay, you've got my attention. This is something else. So, and of all the arguments, that one touched my heart. So the others touched my mind, but the resurrection one just seemed to penetrate another aspect of me. But I'm going to lie if I tell you today that I believe because of those things. Mm-hmm. They were gateway drugs, so to speak. But if somebody gives me a book on the cosmological argument today, I'm going to sack it here somewhere. But you know, it's not the first thing I'm going to look at. And if my faith is in trouble, I'm not like, oh, I need to go get the cosmological argument. I need to go look at that again. You know, it's since moved into, you know, many different places, especially something like beauty and something like meaning. And you know, I discovered guys like Tim Keller, later Tim Mackie, and even N.T. Wright, and just this wonderful meta narrative of the Bible and how everything connects, and it just really warms my heart. And that's not necessarily an argument that you can give to a skeptic and say, "Ah, read the Bible, just look how beautiful it is." But it is to me. I think it's a very profound argument, as a matter of fact. But it's not in this strict evidential space anymore, if that makes any sense. So I think, like, as a gateway drug, I would say the cosmological argument, the moral argument, and the resurrection.
Okay.
That did well.
And did you return to C.S. Lewis during this time, or was he still up on the shelf looking at some of these new apologists that you'd been introduced to?
No, I mean, he was just referenced the whole time. So I think it was Alfred North Whitehead or somebody who said that everything is footnotes to Plato. In the apologetics community, everything is footnotes to C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. Although some of my friends would argue that it's actually footnotes to Chesterton. I mean, they can fight that out. But he just came back again and again and again. And you know what? Even when it wasn't purely apologetics, I remember somebody close to me died shortly after that. And I was just looking at A Grief Observed. And that really spoke to me and nourished me, you know, as I was sort of wrestling with this thing. And it wasn't a strict apologetic necessarily. It was very raw and whatnot, but that was something that really meant something to me. And probably the book that I've given to the most people in my life is Mere Christianity. And I even started giving away that book when I wasn't even sure if I'm a Christian. But I was so impressed by, man, this is at least a pretty good account of Christianity. Maybe too good of an account, but you can figure it out for yourself. So C.S. Lewis, I say in my sermons as well that I'm under contract to quote him at least once a sermon. he's all over the place.
So how has he shaped your thinking, do you think?
It depends on which level you are talking about. So I think right in the beginning, I held on to the idea that the Gospels was not myth, it was something else, was his line just about things that just doesn't fit and it's too sloppy. Put together, and it just had all the marks of eyewitness testimony. So in the beginning, I really liked that evidential side of his story. And then later on, his gritty theodicy, and I'm more referring to A Grief Observed rather than The Problem of Pain, was at one point that really had a massive impact on me. And I think the thing that probably had the biggest impact on me later on, I mean, that's difficult. It's difficult to distinguish because there are different phases and different C.S. Lewis literature that speaks to you in different times, right? But later on, when I did my master's, I did it on the monomyth and the messianic myth in superhero stories. And You know, I was thinking of Marvel and Harry Potter, and these things always spoke to me. And I wasn't quite sure why it spoke to me. I even had a bit of a spiritual experience, you know, when watching these superheroes give their life and then somehow coming back and whatnot. And he was the guy, I mean, way back in the 50s, 60s, thinking about these things theologically, you know, the dying and rising gods, and how to make sense of it. And as a matter of fact, the only time I first encountered dying, rising gods with his Mithras, Dionysius, Isis. You've heard the Jesus myth theory, sure. I thought it was this massive objection against Christianity. And C.S. Lewis just turns it on its head. And he says, no, no, no. He says, it must be true. This story is written on all of our hearts. And so he just flipped it around completely. And so I've read a lot of his work on fairy tales and then obviously how Narnia worked and just that mechanism. So although it started, I was first intrigued by his more evidential stuff. What later worked on my heart more was this longing, this desire, maybe one can call it the argument from desire and the subtle ways in which he spoke about in which he would present stories and just see show that these stories embody this massive longing that we have in our heart, but maybe that is the ultimate truth of the universe. And the fact that we long for it is a sign attesting to that fact.
Yuan, this year marks 60 years since C.S. Lewis's death. I mean, do you think that he is still relevant today? He obviously had a significant impact on your own faith journey, but do you think 60 years after his death, he can still speak relevantly to people today?
I read Alistair McGrath's biography on Lewis, and right at the end, I read it a while ago, so I need to record it now, but apparently after his death, people didn't really take much notice and wasn't that popular. And there were a lot of Christians that were actually warning against him. I'm not sure if I read it there, but apparently somebody like John Stott, who many of us really like, apparently he said, be careful of Lewis, please fact check that. And I have not met a person either wrestling with his faith or her faith or coming to faith that didn't somehow have C.S. Lewis along that path. It is absolutely incredible. This one friend of mine really struggling with his faith recently. He's a bit of a famous actor type guy, yeah. And and he just says, Juan, there's nothing in my I feel like I'm drifting away, I'm walking away. So I give him Mere Christianity, as is my practice. And this guy just writes me, oh, he just phones me, but he swears, so I can't repeat it, but he just says, why isn't this naughty word in a foreword to the Bible? This should be stuck in the front of every Bible that you buy and so that you can read a bit of C.S. Lewis and Mere Christianity before you tackle some of these bigger issues. So no, it is still very much the case that he is incredibly influential here in the southern tip of Africa, actually. And it's interesting that if you go to our secular bookstores, they will have a little Christian section. And there will be a couple of horrible, like, self-help nonsense books. And the only decent books that you'll get there, the No Tim Keller, no John Stott or whatever, but C.S. Lewis will be there. His influence endures. And like I said, when I'm in trouble in a sermon and I need to spice things up, give myself a little bit of credibility, I just need to drop in a C.S. Lewis quote. They just always save me.
Yuan, thank you so much. I so appreciate all of the time that you've spent talking to me today.
Thanks, Ruth. It was great.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And do register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.